In 1994, the United States, Canada, and Mexico implemented NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. At the time, proponents of the landmark agreement said that NAFTA would create hundreds of thousands of high-wage jobs in the U.S. It was also supposed to jolt Mexico's economy into the first world and transform it into a robust market for American goods. After 17 years, it's clear that NAFTA hasn't lived up to expectations. After the August recess, Congress is set to vote on three more free trade agreements, this time with South Korea, Panama, and Colombia. With President Obama and politicians on both sides of the aisle under tremendous pressure to create jobs, the likelihood is high that the deals will pass. To help sift through the facts and myths of free trade agreements, I spoke with Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program at the Center for International Policy in Mexico City. It seems that in the area of job creation, free trade agreements are not all they're cracked up to be.
There's a lot of funny business behind the statistics, as often happens. I live in Mexico City, and one of the best case analysis we have is the North American Free Trade Agreement. And in Mexico, what's happened is that there's clearly been massive job displacement. That is, people have lost jobs in Mexico as a result of the Free Trade Agreement. And that's been an impetus toward the huge rise in immigration.
Everybody here thinks we lost jobs to Mexico.
That's also true. And we know that this is true because there's a special program under NAFTA that funds workers that have been displaced by NAFTA. So there's actually a registry of thousands and thousands of jobs that have been lost. And people in communities throughout the United States know this because they've seen their factories close down. And they know that those factories went to Mexico or they went to other places. So why would you have a net job loss? There's a number of reasons for it. One, they go to other places. Much of the jobs that went to Mexico have now gone off to China or Asian countries where it's even cheaper to produce. And another is that there's a process, too, of mechanization and of turning away from production to speculation and financial industries. So workers in all countries are being hurt. And they're not only being hurt because there are fewer jobs, but because the conditions of those jobs are worse. When you create these treaties that basically give corporations the option of going anywhere they can find the cheapest place to produce, then that means that you're driving salaries down. That means that they're free to look for places where labor laws either don't exist or aren't enforced, where environmental laws and other costs are lower because they're not enforced as well. And that's what's happening on a global basis with the free trade agreement.
Would it be safe to say that what happened in Mexico was that a lot of agricultural workers lost their jobs and left their jobs when the U.S. brought a lot of its agricultural and corn to Mexico, and those people had to find jobs in factories and other places? That was their displacement. Ours was more manufacturing-based.
Yes. There was a lot of manufacturing displacement in Mexico as well, especially small and medium industries that produce for the domestic market. And in the United States, it was the factories that has been that have mostly closed and moved off to what they call the offshore assembly plants or the maquiladoras in Mexico, where labor is much, much cheaper. There have been about 2 million displaced farmers in the United States, and that's a good example of how jobs are just lost altogether. Because these are subsistence farmers. They work just a couple acres oftentimes for feeding their own families, but they also had to sell a certain amount of their product to be able to buy the other things that they needed. And when they had to sell that, the price had gone down so low because of imports that they were no longer able to make a living. And mechanized farming.
So there were 300, you mentioned 3 million farmers in Mexico that lost their jobs?
Yeah, the estimates are around 2 million. And again, they're estimates because there's not a real good registry of this, but the immigration rate just soared after NAFTA, and that was a big reason behind it.
Well, now as the free trade agreements move on to Colombia and Panama and South Korea, do the same rules apply? Because we're hearing about things like U.S. wheat has become uncompetitive if we're going to export it to Colombia. Canada's got a free trade agreement with Colombia. They don't have a duty on their wheat. We have a 13% duty on our wheat. Our business has been shrinking, and we should cut this deal with Colombia so we can get back in.
All the same rules apply. What people think is really a big myth, that free trade agreements are about nation against nation. How does one country, the United States, get a competitive advantage over another country by entering into a free trade agreement? And that's not what they're about. What they're really about is how do you create more favors and more facilities for gigantic transnational corporations to take advantage of natural resources and labor in other countries. So it's not a U.S. worker against a Mexican worker or a U.S. company against a Colombian company. In the case of wheat, for example, that wheat's getting produced and it's getting sold. It's not going to make a huge difference to have a free trade agreement with Colombia and open up another market, which is, after all, a rather small market in the scheme of things for U.S. wheat farmers. What it does make a difference in is the conditions under which U.S. investors go to Colombia to establish businesses, to use Colombian workers, to use Colombian natural resources for their own growth. And that's the same with South Korea, which is also up, and with Panama. People are starting to look at the specific situations with each of these. In Colombia, there's a problem with human rights. In Panama, there's a problem that it's a tax haven. And in South Korea, there were problems with the beef industry and the auto industry. But in reality, it's the whole model that we have to look at. And we saw that come up during the elections in 2008. And then suddenly, the Obama administration has become a major promoter of free trade agreement. And all the rhetoric about how NAFTA should be renegotiated and how job loss in the United States was an important condition or consideration because of the outsourcing that's encouraged by free trade agreements has seemed to have fallen away.
Now, candidate Obama really hung his hat on the Colombia issue, on the death and killing of union leaders. And he said, we've got to have effective prosecutions, and that's got to stop before any free trade agreement goes on with Colombia. How did that work out? Can he say, well, there's been an improvement in that, and now I'm for it?
It didn't work out at all. Last year's figures were 51 unionists that were assassinated, and it's gone up every single year. It has not gone down. So then last April, they came out with what they called the Labor Action Plan, that they're going to fix this problem of labor union assassinations in Colombia through an action plan. And since then, 10 more union leaders have been assassinated. So nothing is fixed. The action plan was used basically to whitewash a situation that continues to be brutal and bloody. And it's not just that there's a human rights problem in Colombia. It's that since this is in the labor sector, what we see is that Colombia uses the murder of labor union leaders to keep down labor rights. And we're going to open the door to companies to go in and use that as a competitive advantage through a free trade agreement? That's just not right.
And unions in Colombia and unions in the United States are both against it.
Yes, the AFL-CIO has come out very strongly against the Colombian Free Trade Agreement, and they say that this labor action plan will not fix the situation, that there are no real signs that the situation is improving, and that, in fact, it's gotten worse.
It seems like the Obama administration is more anxious to do this so that they do look like they're creating jobs, so that people are feeling like they're making economic progress? How do you rank why the Obama administration wants to do this?
It's difficult to know because in 2010, the latest poll that we have, 53% of the American public said that they believe that free trade agreements hurt the United States, mostly because of the job issue. They're seeing those factories close in their communities. They're finding out that those factories are going to other countries. They know that the way workers are treated in those other countries. So it'd be hard to believe that the Obama administration is doing this because they think they're going to sell the idea that free trade agreements create jobs. Most people simply don't believe that. I would only have to believe that the lobbying of both the government of Colombia, for example, that spent millions and millions of dollars lobbying for this agreement when its own people are living in poverty, as well as major corporations that are looking for those investment conditions and for opening up some of those markets, has had an influence in changing the position of the Obama administration to the point that they're favoring those interests above what would be good for the American public.
Is Colombia's strategic value to the United States something that factors in here, that the United States sees Colombia as a friend in Latin America? It's a ballast against Hugo Chavez and a different model. Is that reason why the United States would want to preserve a free trade deal with Colombia?
It's important that you brought that up, because I think it really is something that's important. The geopolitical aspect of having that free trade agreement with Colombia is high on the list of priorities of the State Department and of the U.S. government. You know, the free trade agreement of the Americas fell apart when Brazil and Argentina opposed it, and that was a blow to the Bush administration, not only in the economic sense of having an area where free trade, there were no barriers to U.S. transnational corporations, but also in the geopolitical sense. Because what we know is with these agreements, there's a greater dependency on the U.S. economy, and this limits the ability of other countries, and in particular Latin American countries, to form South-South links, to have more diversity within their foreign relations. And that dependence leads to a greater military dependence and a greater ability of the U.S. government to sort of get what it wants in those countries. With NAFTA, we've seen it really clearly, because the free trade agreement was extended into a security agreement that then led to the Merida Initiative and the involvement of the U.S. in the drug war, and a level of military and security and intelligence involvement within Mexican territory that's unprecedented. So now the idea has been, since the free trade agreement of the Americas fell apart, to create a Pacific rim of countries that all have free trade agreements, that all have an orientation towards the United States, and that then can be linked into common security plans that aren't necessarily in the interest of the U.S. people or of those countries themselves.
You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonald, speaking with Laura Carlson. She's director of the Americas Program for the Center for International Policy. She's based in Mexico City, and we're talking about the proposed free trade agreements with South Korea, Panama, and Colombia. Is there a different model out there for the United States? If the U.S. wanted to take a different approach, what kind of things would it do?
Sure. It's necessary to have trade agreements, because trade has to be predictable, and it's obviously necessary to have trade regulation and investment regulation with predictable and transparent laws. This free trade model is not just getting rid of barriers. It's a very particular and very drastic model. It means that corporations can sue governments for earnings that they might not receive in the future, and in courts that are set up by the agreement itself, which is a bizarre concept, and corporations almost always win in this setting. It also means that countries are not able to regulate financial sectors, something that, again, is completely contradictory to what our experience has been with the financial crisis. It means that many countries, especially developing countries, are not able to put into place simple rules for protecting weak sectors in development that the United States used when it was in its development stage. So there's a lot of things, including in other intellectual property laws where you can't have generic medicines, that are bad for the public, that are bad for the people that are part of these agreements and have no business even really being in a free trade agreement. Groups are calling for enforceable labor standards so that companies cannot abuse and exploit workers in other countries, and they're not on an uneven playing field with U.S. workers. They're calling for an end to these investor state provisions that allow corporations to sue governments for, say, environmental protections. Generic medicines for sick people. They're conceiving of a fair trade agreement that would be the counterpart to these free trade agreements. And there's certainly a lot of ways that that could be done.
Who exactly writes these agreements? If we're in a situation where it sounds like corporations have more authorship of these things than other folks, do labor unions have a say in this? They always seem to object. Other civil society groups?
Not very much. There's been a lot of pressure. We have to remember, like, these agreements that are on the table right now, these three, many of them have been signed since 2007. And so one good sign is that faith-based groups, labor groups in particular, and other citizens' groups for fair trade have been able to block these being ratified by Congress for so many years because there's so many concerns about it, and even politicians began to see it at different points through the process as a political liability, as we saw again in the 2008 elections. But there's a lot of evidence as the history comes out that corporations are directly involved in drafting these agreements. We know Cargill was involved in opening up the agriculture sector and setting their specific terms. This is what we want out of a trade and investment agreement. The Bush administration was very closely allied to these interests and allowed that to continue. And now when we have some alternatives that people are putting forward to how these could be fixed, it's been an uphill battle to get those changes made. The Democratic Party came out with a platform. Some of those were incorporated, but they haven't really changed the model itself, which is highly skewed toward the interests of transnational corporations.
Colombia has such a problematic history with its multinational corporations, and the Obama administration knows this well. The Attorney General represented Chiquita in their relationship with the paramilitary death squads, which they pled guilty to. What are the unique things about that country?
What you mentioned is very important because what it shows us is that the presence of transnational corporations and foreign investment in Colombia historically, and this can be predicted into the future quite safely, is that they're anything but a progressive force. The Chiquita papers that you mentioned, there's been a recent discovery of more papers, and what we know is they not only paid protection as a form of extortion, which is what they pled guilty to, but they were actually paying actively for security. This means they were providing paramilitary organizations registered as terrorist organizations by the U.S. government to buy guns and to kill people. The Colombian Attorney General estimates that 4,000 murders are a direct result of those payments. And Eric Holder was the defense attorney at that time. And now it's come out that this was actively going on, even since the plea bargain that they pled guilty to. So this is one of the Latin American skeletons in the closet of Eric Holder. And it'll be interesting to see what happens as a result of that. The other cases in Colombia that have to do with transnational corporations include the exploitation of labor and the abuses there. So many of the cases aren't really solved that it's difficult for us to know exactly what happened. But the AFL-CIO has come out and said that transnational corporations are a factor in suppressing labor because their interests are to make as much money for the cheapest conditions possible.
Do you think that this round of free trade agreements, if the Obama administration decides it wants to pass it and pushes Democrats in the Senate and Congress about this, it's going to pass. This is something that they were the people who were objecting to in the previous years. Now they're going to flip on this because of pressures from the economy.
There's a lot of evidence that it has a good chance of passing, although we wouldn't have believed it, say, just a few years ago. And it certainly looks like the Obama administration will be pushing it. Ron Kirk, the trade representative, is pushing it. In fact, they want to get it passed in September, all three of them as a package deal, as soon as possible after the recess. So it will really depend on what the public does and if there's much of an outcry, the pressure that can be put to bear by organized labor and also by these citizen groups that are coming out against it. If there's a strong opinion among the public, then people may be seeing that as liability. What's ironic, again, is it's not just Obama that's flipped on this issue. There were a number of candidates in the 2008 elections that actually took office on a fair trade platform against free trade agreements. And we've had reports from organizations in Washington that say the lobbying has been so intense that they've been flipping a number of these candidates just in the past months.
Laura Carlson is director of the Americas Program for the Center for International Policy. She's based in Mexico City. Thanks for joining us and talking about the proposed free trade deals with Colombia and Panama and South Korea.
Thank you, Trump.
If you're interested in hearing more about international trade, tune in to Worldview's regular time slot on Labor Day, and we'll air an hour-long special called International Trade, Free, Fixed, or Fair. It highlights the growing challenges of the fair trade movement through the eyes of a farmer and a founder of the leading fair trade certification program. That's coming up Monday at noon here on WBEZ.